And we've got 2, 4, 5 bills, and what we'll do is we'll take the all in order except for Senate Bill 40. We'll put that last. That seems to be the one that may cause a little bit of discussion. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2429. Mr. Dawson.
House Bill 2429 makes offense of acting as vehicle dealer without certificate an unlawful trade practice. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
All right. Who do we have signed up to testify? Come on up. Good to see you, State Representative.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mike Schaufler, District 48. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2429. There was no... This went through Business, Labor, Consumer Affairs, as you know, a committee I sit on. There was no opposing testimony at committee that I remember. It passed to the floor unanimously, and if my memory serves me, it passed unanimously on the floor to you all. We're talking about folks here, in my opinion, that just aren't playing by the rules. We're not talking about people who sell their own cars. These are folks that hide their vehicle sales for any number of reasons, including they don't want to pay taxes on their income, don't want to be responsible for the vehicles they sell as a business person, they want to be on the ownership records, have been suspended or revoked of having a dealer's license, they don't want to pay their fair share of the industry regulatory costs, they don't want to compete on an even playing field with other dealers, don't want to advertise fairly with proper disclosures to their customers on branded titles or wrecked cars, and don't want to comply with environmental rules on air, water, and land pollution controls. Now, I'm not a used car dealer or a new car dealer. I'm not an expert, but I did just renew my contractor's license at great cost to me, we do that so we can police our industry, which protects me as a business person and protects the people we work for, the consumer. My wife's a dentist. She has to go through the exact same thing in her field. We don't want people drilling on teeth that aren't qualified, aren't licensed, insured. And in my opinion, these folks just don't want to do that. And I think it would be fair that they do have to jump through the same hoops for very good reasons that other business people do, too. If I pound one nail in somebody's house, I'm a contractor, and I have to have a license for it. So that's about all I have to say today. If you have any questions of me, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Questions? I have one, Representative Schaufler. It's a little bit unrelated to the topic of the bill, but you mentioned you just got your contractor's license renewed. Could you tell me how much you paid for that?
It is, let me see, $1,200, about $1,400, just to get, that's for my liability and my bond and my license.
Okay.
Just before I do drive one nail or dig one shovel, I got that cost comes to me before I ever start.
Thank you. I just wanted my committee to hear that. It's relative to another bill.
Right. Okay.
I want you to think that we have high principles here, but we're also working on our own bills.
Okay. And I'm a very small contractor. I'm not a big contractor, so I'm sure the cost goes up as the projects get larger.
Okay. Representative Elton.
Senator
Dalton, introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dalto, Oregon House District 21. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to stop by to find out if I could answer any questions on this bill. In my previous life, I was a salesperson. I sold new and used cars, and so I know the problems that consumers can experience, particularly with curbers, which are people that are unlicensed that are selling multiple numbers of cars out of unlicensed lots or their homes or things like that, and what a consumer protection issue that is. This is essentially a housekeeping bill that would afford consumers additional protection, and I encourage you to pass it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both, representatives.
Thank you.
Over. Appreciate it very much. Cheryl, where are you at? Come on up. Good afternoon. Welcome again.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I work for the Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I just would advise the committee that the department is taking a neutral position on this bill. It essentially, we would say, puts a finer point on a more general provision in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Currently, that act prohibits a person from misrepresenting that they are certified to do something when in fact they are not. We have taken the position in cases where we've gone after unlicensed dealers that in holding themselves out as a dealer, whether or not they're advertising or not, if they're set up in a parking lot and they're selling cars to the public, they're acting as a dealer. And we've always taken the position that impliedly they are holding out to the public that they are certified to engage in that activity when in fact they are not so. And we've prosecuted them under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act under that theory. What House Bill 2429 would do would simply to make it a per se violation that if a person is acting as a vehicle dealer without being so registered, ergo, it's a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It omits that intermediary analysis that we currently engage in to get to the same result. We think that, you know, for purposes of consumer protection, this is probably a good idea. There have been several instances where the Department of Justice, in concert with the Department of Motor Vehicles, have identified persons engaging in the unlawful act of acting as a vehicle dealer. They've taken administrative action, and we've taken action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act against those persons. But, like I say, this would probably just give us a straighter route to the same result.
What's the penalties, range of penalties on an unlawful trade practices?
In actions brought by the Department of Justice, first of all, we would have to demonstrate that there's a pattern or practice, so it's more than one vehicle being sold. If we demonstrate that there's a pattern or practice, we can ask the court for civil penalties of up to $25,000 per violation. I would note that it's in extreme cases that we will ask for that much right off the bat. We usually will temper the amount of civil penalties that we request by the facts of a particular case.
Is that a per day violation? Is it $25,000 a day?
We would probably consider it per transaction, so per car sold.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Musk.
Cheryl, if you could just expand on that a little bit. So, under the law, when are you required to have a dealer's license? In other words, what is the level of activity? What's the litmus test there for being considered a dealer rather than an individual?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I'm slightly out of my area. The Department of Motor Vehicles sets out the requirements for being a vehicle dealer. They're in ORS
822-005. I'm looking at it.
And there are certain exemptions that exist for selling your personal car, selling up to a certain number of cars per year. You wouldn't have to be exempt. But they're set out in DMV statute, and I think further elaborated by administrative rule. So what this would do is it basically would look to those statutes to determine whether or not a person, for engaging in the activity they're engaging in, should have a vehicle dealer's license. If they should and they don't, then we could take action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act under 2429.
And then upon passage of this bill, then, I was just looking at the staff summary from the House discussion that this would be better than the current system of DMV, you know, finding such individuals. And you have used, basically have got to the this particular point anyway through the process. But if this defines that the violation is now a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, does this then supersede and preclude the DMV then from finding individuals under the current rules, because this now takes precedence and DMV would no longer be in a position to find under their existing rules for these type of violations, and it would strictly be under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, no, it would not supersede it. In fact, these rules would, or this law and DMV's authority would coexist. And our agencies have a lot of interaction with one another. What often happens is that the Department of Motor Vehicles itself, the business regulation sections, will alert us to a dealer or to a person acting as an unlicensed dealer. And typically when they alert us, it's usually someone that they've issued civil penalties against who's failed to pay and who has continued to engage in the unlawful act, and they're just operating sort of outside of the bounds of their administrative authority. In cases like that, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is very helpful because it gives us the authority to go to circuit court, file a complaint, and to seek injunctive relief up to and including, you know, shutting the business down. So it would augment the authority of the Department of Motor Vehicles in that regard.
Mr. Chair, once again, Representative Dalto, House District 21, members of the committee. I raised down when I heard Senator Metzger's question about, you know, what constitutes a dealer, and I wanted to answer that. Basically, you want to think about it as folks that are selling cars to make a living. If you're going to sell a personal vehicle, and if you're going to sell it once a year or twice a year, but it's not really your intent to make a living on it, it's just, you know, liquidating a personal vehicle for whatever reason, that's not curbing a car. That's not making a living off of it. But if you're going to sell one car a month, or, you know, a couple of cars a year for the purpose of trying to make a living, or if you're going to engage in the practice of purchasing cars with the intent of reselling them for a profit, then that's kind of how you want to think of it. And it's a little bit of a gray area. It's tough to say, well, you know, where do you end selling personal vehicles for profit and where do you begin selling vehicles professionally, basically. But if you're selling a couple of vehicles a month or one vehicle a month or maybe six vehicles a year, you're a dealer. You're just and you should be licensed so that consumers have that protection and they have somebody to come to if you sell them a vehicle that doesn't meet their expectations.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dalto. I have the statute in front of me, 822.015. And it does state that if you have sold no more than five vehicles in one calendar year, you're exempt if you can prove that you own the vehicles primarily for personal or family or household use. And then after that, that's when you need to register, and that's pretty much what your testimony was. So that clarifies it.
Sometimes it gets complicated.
And farm vehicles are also exempt. Tractors.
Senator Meyer, you have any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Got some more Monty King and Daryl Fuller. Welcome, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King, Executive Director, Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. And I'm sitting this far away from Daryl because I have a cold, and I'd better give it to him, but he doesn't want it. So, if I might, just at the first, I'd like to give you my interpretation of 822.015. Under 822.015, sub 2, it exempts you for vehicles that are titled in your name. If you bought those or are selling those or anything else, if they've been used for your personal use. So if people are not titling their vehicles in their own name, then they're not exempt under the law. So as long as people title the vehicles in their own name and they're selling five, or even 30, as long as they can prove they were for their own personal use, they're exempt. Now, if a person bought 30, traded in 29, I'd say they're still for their personal use. But if they've bought 31 or so, and they haven't titled any of them, then I think they're a dealer. And we do have cases at DMV late 2001 where a person did buy 31 vehicles that they documented. And he was an unlicensed dealer, and he got cited for that. At that point, he only got a $2,500 citation, though. Now, there's 31 people he sold a vehicle to. Those vehicles weren't very good. And once he was cited, then those consumers should have the right to go after that guy for his unfair trade practices, for the damages that he caused them. Now, we really believe the main enforcement of this is not Department of Justice. I don't think they have the budget or the desire to go after a whole lot of curbers or anything. But the enforcement really is consumer attorneys going after illegal dealers who have already been cited for unlicensed dealing. And at that point, they should have the right to go after that curber for their damages, just like anybody else can go after any dealer right now for the damages caused by an unfair trade practice. And if you want to go into what are unfair trade practices in the car industry, I don't think we have enough time for that. There are a number of problems. We've been trying to deal with them. There's an awful lot of good dealers out there who don't do any of them. But we believe that the unlicensed dealers should have the same problem with attorneys that licensed dealers do when they do the same things to the consumers. That's really what the issue is about.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Darrell Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. OADA represents franchise new car dealers in Oregon. And in accordance with OADA's Paperwork Reduction Act of 2003, I did not prepare any written testimony today. If you would like some, I'd be glad to bring you a piece of stationery later on today. We are in support of the bill, and I want to indicate that, as most of you know, the automobile is the second largest consumer purchase that most people make. And as such, some state regulation of the industry is appropriate, and if an individual is not acting within the scope of the licensing requirements that we have in the state of Oregon, we believe that the state ought to have the resources to go after those people and make sure that they are punished for acting as a vehicle dealer without a license. A couple of sessions ago, the penalty for somebody who was selling 10 or 12 cars would be a DMV fine, and it wasn't a per vehicle violation. It was just a violation of acting as a unlicensed vehicle dealer, and they might get a fine of $1,000. Well, for unlicensed dealers, that was simply the cost of doing business. They would pay the fine, move their shop someplace else, and set up, and if they got caught again the next year, well, they'd pay the $1,000 fine because they could pay that fine and still be making a profit on their unlicensed business. A bill that was introduced last session, I believe, by the Used Car Dealers Association changed that to a $5,000 per vehicle violation for unlicensed dealers that DMV is now using effectively to go after quite a number of unlicensed dealers to make sure that they are penalized to a degree that it makes it less profitable for them to sell vehicles as an unlicensed dealer. This simply adds another arrow to that quiver in terms of providing now another government agency, the Department of Justice, and again, private rights of action, to go after people who are selling, again, the second largest consumer product that people purchase, and doing it in such a way that protects them from the sort of rules and regulations that really are appropriate for sales of this type. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions?
No.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Al Elkins and Deb Elkins. Hello, welcome.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Deb Elkins. I'm the director of the Northwest Automotive Trades Association. We represent the folks that repair cars, repair your cars in the event of an accident, the transmission shops, tire dealers, or the aftermarket organization in Oregon. I'm here today to ask maybe for the committee to postpone any action on this bill. We have some concerns. Our industry appreciates the work of the auto dealers in Oregon and their efforts to bring this bill before you. But what happened has happened over the last year has been some questions around how my people acquire cars and how they in fact dispose of their cars. Whenever a vehicle is brought into a repair shop and maybe is not picked up by the consumer, my folks are in a position of using the lien process. It's a statutory lien process, a very cumbersome process that they use in which to dispose of these vehicles. Last year, several questions came up about whether or not this process, once this process was complete and we sold that vehicle, were we in fact a dealer? And that question is being wrestled with as we speak on the House side. We introduced a bill, House Bill 2455, that asks for some clarification. It's asking you folks on the House side to make a policy decision and help us to resolve this problem. So our concerns are is that currently, if there's questions on whether or not my people need a dealer's license, they could very well be in violation, if this bill were passed, could be in violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We've talked to the Attorney General's office, and we feel we have some better understanding on the bill's intent, but we would still, like I said, just like to have some time in which to try to resolve this problem. I do have a repair shop owner with me today that could answer some technical questions about the lien process. That's not my forte. So unless you have some questions, I will turn it over to him.
I just have one. Where is House Bill 2459? Do you know where?
2455. It is in House Transportation, Representative Brown's committee.
This issue wasn't brought up on the other side.
No, it was not.
Sir.
Hi, Mr. Chair, committee, I'm Bob Anderson. Excuse me. I own a business here in town called AJ's Auto Repair. And just to maybe shed some light on how we get these cars in the event that it's not perfectly clear to the committee, we get these cars in a number of fashions, but we never get them with the intent of reselling them for a profit, which, based on the testimony that I have heard through this process, clearly illustrates to me that we don't fall under that the need of a dealer's license. Many of these automobiles, most of them come to us, and there's no equity in these cars. In other words, the consumer is upside down in the car. They've refinanced it, or they've purchased it, and they can't make payments. And when it breaks, they clearly can't make the repair. So at that point in time, we become the dumping grounds for these scrap automobiles that have no equity. So it's not our intent to use the lien process to shield us from the fact that we need a dealer's license to sell cars to make money. We repair automobiles for money. As I said, the way we get the cars, we get them in a number of fashions. To make that point clear, I received one last week that was sold by a licensed dealer that failed in such a fashion a week after the purchase, which was as is in said condition, in such a fashion that the automobile simply did not warrant repair. We now have that automobile. So we need to have an avenue to get rid of these cars, and I don't really feel like our industry ought to be licensed to do this because we do not make a profit doing it. Thank you.
Questions for Mark?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I can do no more than echo what the previous two speakers have said. We will, in effect, tow the car from Bob's shop and then take it through a lien process, no doubt, and then eventually try to either get rid of it through a crusher or a wrecking yard, or try to sell it for parts at a wrecking yard if it's not running. We have previous speakers have talked to the fact that we have a better understanding of the bill's impact after talking to the Attorney General's office, but we'd still like to have further talkings with them in relation to our bills and this bill as well. So we would ask that you not take any action on the bill today.
I have here something about Senate Bill 622 in this session.
Yes, that's the same bill as House Bill 2455. It's in Senate Judiciary.
And that's in Judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very good. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have some concern here, so we'll...
I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, since the Attorney General is here representing the Department of Justice, I was just curious whether, in fact, those concerns are valid and need additional work or not. I would just be curious as to what that reaction was.
Yeah, so Cheryl, do you want to come back up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
members of the committee. Once again, Cheryl Pellegrini, Department of Justice. Senator Metzger, Pete Shepard, the Deputy Attorney General, has been working with a group that I believe was convened by Representative Close. And that group is looking at this whole issue in the context of these two bills. I haven't been a part of those discussions. I can report that what the towers have told you, that they have concerns about whether or not they're in or out of the dealer licensing laws is accurate. They do have those concerns. I would leave it up to
think,
you all.
I think you answered the question. I think you answered the question. Thank
any
you.
Questions? Okay. We'll take a little more time with that and try. You guys, the interested parties here, get together and try and work this out. We'll try to get these bills out. You know, when there are time deadlines as far as moving things on the Senate side, April 11th, and we have a pretty tight schedule as it is, and so. Sounds like there's some good consumer things involved in this thing, and just want to make sure we take care of your problem. So we'll shut the committee here and set this up for next week if possible. Okay, open up public hearing on Senate Bill 243.
Senate Bill 243 modifies notification requirement for discontinuance of certain cemeteries, requires prior approval of Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission for discontinuance of Pioneer Cemeteries. No revenue impact, has minimal fiscal impact, and there's an amendment.
All right. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Hamrick, Assistant Director for Heritage Conservation at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I'm back here before you with the second of three bills that the Commission has introduced this session. You might remember the first one was to change their name to the Heritage Cemeteries Commission. The part of the Commission's statutory authorities are to make recommendations to the Assembly for ideas or that will help provide better protection for these unique cultural resources in Oregon. This bill, excuse me, as amended by the -1 amendments, which we are supporting, would require, instead of approval of the commission to discontinue a dedication, would actually give the commission a give notice and a review prerogative to the commission. And talking with discussions with cemetery organizations and constituents, it became clear that a review and comment role would be the best approach for this issue. The other nice thing about this legislation, which is in the original bill, is that it would broaden the amount of notification that was needed so that, because part of the statutory authority says that they will try to get in contact with next of kin. And so the bill would ask that there be statewide notification at least twice prior to any hearing to remove this sort of dedication. Finally, and this was a recommendation in the -1 amendments, which was not in the original bill, there was a recommendation that the word dilapidated, the phrase dilapidated, which appears in Section 2, lines 27 and 28, that phrase, or such cemetery has been allowed to remain in dilapidated condition for a period of 5 years or longer, be removed. It was put in the 50s, and it was most of our constituents believe that the word is subjective and that it can be used as a synonym for the word neglected or needing maintenance, and that basically when in fact a lot of pioneer cemeteries they do look neglected for one reason or another. We have run these both the -1s and the original legislation passed, and former Representative Mannix, who was the person who created the commission in the 1999 session, and would be glad to answer any questions and appreciate your time and thank you for your opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Senator.
Well, my only question would be, is this bill in conflict with our other bill, since we changed the name of the cemeteries to Heritage Cemeteries, and we refer to it as, Pioneer Cemetery Commission? I mean, is that going to be changed too, or?
Senator Metzger, it's my understanding that name change bill is still in committee over on the other side, and it's my understanding that at the end of session, these things, if they've made it through, that, that this bill will be conformed to the other bill.
Very good. Further questions? Is there Charlotte? Mattins?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Heritage Cemetery Group. Not wanting to steal her thunder, with me is President Charlotte Benz, who I would like to refer to make comments, and then if I could follow up at the brief.
Charlotte, introduce yourself.
Okay, Senator Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Charlotte Benz. I am president of the Heritage Cemetery Group, which is a statewide organization made up of a lot of other cemeteries. Mostly they are pioneer cemeteries. I also chair a small cemetery in Sherwood, Washington County, which is also a pioneer cemetery, so I kind of have hands-on there. We have worked very hard with the Pioneer Commission on this legislation, and I think given the amendments here, largely working those out with them, we are feeling comfortable with this the way it is written, and I think we're ready to have it move forward, be in support.
Just very quickly, for the record, under this legislation, if a cemetery provides notice to the commission, basically, we believe very strongly that it is incumbent upon the commission to act promptly in its review and its comments so as to not hang up operating cemeteries that are out there. So just for the record, we want to make clear that this is something that needs to be done in a prompt, uniform manner and not be used as something to hold a hostage.
You're in good shape as far as the amendment is concerned.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So we'll have to get your folks working on that amendment and get it back to us.
Is it here?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't have it here.
One.
How come I missed it?
Okay. There it is.
I missed it. Okay, no problem. Okay, any further folks like to testify on this bill? Now we'll close public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 243.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 243.
Senator Walker's moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 243. Comments from the committee? Any objections? So ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 243 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker's moved Senate Bill 243 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments, questions, objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, you want to carry that?
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks.
Ah, very good.
She's back today.
We're calling right now.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Okay, welcome to public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Mr. Dotson.
Senate Bill 248 directs the Attorney General to approve form of surety bond or revocable letter of credit obtained by pawnbroker, modifies examination requirement for pawnbrokers, and requires field examination at Office of Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Mattis. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me is Dale Laswell, who's manager of our non-depository programs in which pawnbroker regulation is housed, who is here to answer any specific questions the committee may have. We're here today to request your support for Senate Bill 248. It basically deals with two straightforward issues. First of all, it clarifies procedural requirements between the Department of Justice and the Department of Consumer and Business Services relating to the approval of surety bonds for pawnbrokers and letters of credit. And secondly, it changes our regulation of pawnbrokers to conform to a Joint Ways and Means Committee budget note from the 2001 Legislative Assembly that we provide a minimal approach to regulation. Currently, the law provides that the Department of Justice must approve each and every surety bond or letter of credit filed with an application of the department before we finally accept it. The law also requires that we conduct at least an annual examination of licensed pawnbrokers. Senate Bill 248 addresses these issues in two ways. In Section 1, it will provide that only the form of the surety bond be approved instead of requiring the Department of Justice to approve each and every single bond or letter of credit. And in Section 2, it clarifies the law to conform to the budget note by providing for a biennial instead of an annual field examination supplemented with an annual report to be filed with the director by each licensed pawnbroker in lieu of our current or our recent past on-site examination. This would not affect our ability should a pawnbroker come to our attention by virtue of the filing or by other means of having a problem. We can still go on-site and perform an examination any time if that is required. The bill is fee neutral. It has no fiscal impact other than we may avoid some few hundreds of dollars in additional DOJ costs that we would avoid in the future. We have spoken with the president of the Oregon Pawnbroker Association. They support the bill, and on our way over here, I was handed a letter from the Pawnbrokers Association signed by Matt Stormberg, the president, supporting the bill, and I will leave that with the committee assistant. We respectfully ask your support for the bill and that it be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Question. You want to testify, or you're just happy to be here?
Happy to be here.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. Can pawnbrokers be licensed to get into the practice of payday lending and car title lending?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, they would suck to meet the same requirements as anybody else going into payday or title loan, other short-term lending.
So they could do it upon application then?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, yes, if they meet the requirements of the statute.
And one other question?
Sure.
Gentlemen, what is the current fees for pawnbrokers? This is legitimate to this bill.
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, the current fee is $350. It had dropped to $150, and we amended the refiled our fee notice and did rulemaking last fall, and it was raised to $350 with no opposition from the pawnbrokers.
Okay. Senator Warren, you're going to have to amend your bill to raise your... Senator Walker has a non-related bill, which is asking for fee increases. So.
These gentlemen know about that bill.
Senator Walker has.
I think we're getting an average here. Further questions?
The last one was $49.
There we go. Okay, no further questions. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? I see none, so we will close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 248.
And Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 248 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 248 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, any questions, any objections? So ordered. And Senator Walker, I don't know, I hate to ask you that too, but do you want to carry this?
Well, market? Maybe one of the rest.
Senator Walker's did.
Thank you very much.
You wanted a pawnbroker,
didn't you? I did, yeah.
Okay, you've got it. Okay, I open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 252. What's your thoughts?
Senate Bill 252. Conforms insurance privacy notice to federal privacy notice requirements. Provides for notice at initiation of insurance transaction. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Very good. Do we have anybody signed up to testify today? Carol Lundberg. Carol, in here. I'm sorry. I'm not reading very well. Excuse me. Please start.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Insurance Administrator for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This bill was before you before, and it was passed out with a due pass recommendation. While it was on the floor, there was some questions that were raised about the privacy requirements, and we had some discussion about that, and we worked out some amendments, which are before you now as dash two. We're comfortable with those amendments, and we would recommend that you send this bill back to the floor with those amendments, so to do pass recommendation.
Okay, any questions?
Yes, thank you. As you recall, the information which was noted by Senator Hannon, I think that started this, was some of the issues regarding concurrent legislation that the body is considering regarding credit scoring and other issues had been brought up, and the concern about that this may provide some latitude to do some of the things of which the body may be considering changing. If you could just articulate what has changed here and you know, the comfort level that this does not necessarily impede that.
Well, the original Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, the original legislation that was amended was conformed with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act with regards to privacy, and that legislation is still on the books. These amendments that were presented in Senate Bill 252 originally were designed to make a differentiation between privacy information at the time that it was acquired and privacy information after it was acquired and how it was dealt with. What the amendment dash two amendments do is it returns the legislation, takes it all the way out, and we're back to the status that we had after the 2001 session, and that just limits the privacy requirements to that which conform with Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. So as far as the credit scoring, it shouldn't have any effect at all on that, because it's just going to require the basic information to the consumer about the how the credit information is being used.
Okay, so again, just sure. To clarify this, so we had an issue at before, as you know, is that this in no way enhances the insurance company's ability to utilize additional information that they do not currently have the rights to do without the permission of the insured.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's absolutely correct. It doesn't enhance any rights. It leaves it exactly the way it is today.
Any questions? Okay, shortly before committee started, for the committee's information, I had a person come to me and say that they would like to look at this for with the new amendments, and the Section 14 was a consideration for them, and so I told them I'd give them another week to work that out. I don't think there's going to be any problem with the bill. We think this is a very crucial bill to be passing out. We've cleaned up the privacy issue, and so we'll give it one more week, and if there's no problems that we can see out of that, well, then we'll just move this thing forward.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we'll close public hearing on 252, and we'll give the interested party an opportunity to check with his people to see whether or not everything is fine as far as they're concerned. So we'll open up a public hearing now on Senate Bill 40. Mr. Duff.
Senate Bill 40 modifies factors used to determine status of worker as employee or independent contractor. No revenue impact, and there is a fiscal statement which I was provided with just moments ago, so I only have one copy. Many members can take a look at it.
Okay. All right. Well, this is an interesting bill, huh? Okay.
This is one fiscal that we're sharing.
Yeah. I don't know. We don't have a page here, do we? Can you, Romy, can you call a page and get a copy of these things? Have you come up and get a copy of all of this? Okay, let's see. Where are we going to start here with all this? Is this a bill that was brought forth by the Bar Association, wasn't it?
Yes.
There's a representative of the Bar Association.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Well, let's have somebody step up. I guess I'm not reading this. Okay. Carrie, that's right. I'm getting close, aren't I? OSB, I was thinking that was only the School Board Association. What was this?
Chair Nelson, if I may request that my colleagues join me.
Please sit up here, gentlemen. Yeah. Just introduce yourself as you...
Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schoenfeld, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar. And with me, to my far left, is Mark Sellers, who is also an attorney with the Oregon State Bar, and Jeff Abbott will be joining us momentarily. All three of us are representatives of the tax section of the Oregon State Bar, and we have proposed Senate Bill 40 to remedy a problem that we see with the definition of independent contractor in the state of Oregon. I think it's important to note that typically our section does not propose legislation because we have different individuals who all have different ideas of what they would like in their tax law. But this is one bill that we all feel very strongly about, and all of our constituents agree that this is a real problem and that we need to find a remedy. Currently, the definition that is used for state tax purposes and for unemployment and workers' compensation insurance is all a very different definition than what is used for purposes of federal tax law. Under federal tax law, we have a tax definition that's been around since 1987. It's called the 20-factor formula. Those of you who have been in business have heard of the 20-factor formula. We acknowledge that it is not a perfect test by any means, but it's something that has been around for 15 years, and practitioners, and most importantly, businessmen and women, understand and are able to use that 20-factor formula. The problem that we see is that the state of Oregon has a very different formula, and that formula is not made of, most businesses aren't aware that it's a separate definition, and so they're following the federal definition and trying to put their employees and workers into this definition. And what we end up having is that individuals who are independent contractors for federal purposes and very clearly are independent contractors for federal purposes suddenly are determined by the state in an audit to be an employee, and the business is out of compliance. I think the two problems we really see with the definition is that there's no knowledge that it's a different formula, but more importantly, many of the factors that are included in the definition of an independent contractor for state law purposes really don't make sense anymore. Some of these issues and requirements is that they have a separate phone line, that they have business cards. These things just really don't make a big difference to some of the different individuals who are out there working as independent contractors. For some it does, but it doesn't make sense for all, and so what it does is make some individuals who really we feel should be independent contractors fall under the state definition of an employee. It's important to note that we're not trying to broaden the definition of who an independent contractor is. We're just trying to tie the definition into what is used for federal purposes so that businesses are not unknowingly out of compliance. I think there are some real examples where we've got an individual maybe that's a bookkeeper who is performing services for several different companies, goes into the business to perform those services because she would have to use the computer of the business. She doesn't have a business card because she already has employment with several different companies and performs this service for the different companies. Doesn't have a separate phone line because there's no reason for anybody to be calling her other than on her regular residence line. For this individual, she would not qualify as an independent contractor for state purposes, though she is clearly an independent contractor for federal purposes. But because she goes into the business and performs those services for state law purposes, she would not be considered an independent contractor. We also see that there's problems for tax purposes. If an individual is treated as an independent contractor for federal, but for state as an employee, does that business file a W-2 for state purposes and a 1099 for federal purposes? I realize we're getting into all of the tax specifications, but I think it even goes broader in that because Oregon adopts the definitions of income from the Internal Revenue Code, we could have a situation where an individual is an independent contractor and should not be covered under retirement plans for federal purposes, but for state law purposes is considered an employee. Technically, that means that I then have an individual who should be covered for state law purposes under the retirement plan, but not for federal purposes. Because Oregon has adopted the definitions under the Internal Revenue Code for what is a qualified retirement plan, for state law purposes, I'm suddenly not in compliance. So there's a lot of problems that we have when we don't have a tie in the definitions. And so we urge you to pass Senate Bill 40 so that we could have more of a connection between the federal and the state definitions. Turn it over.
Please introduce yourself and welcome.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Abbott. I'm an attorney on the tax section of the executive committee of the tax section for the state bar. And I'm also a CPA. and wanted to go on record to support Ms. Schoenfeld's testimony, but also to go further than that in discussing where we had been with the Department of Revenue, our discussions with them, Department of Employment, and the Department of Labor. We had been encouraged to discuss with them our bill and had a telephone conference where several members of their agencies and the people in front of you now were on telephone conference with them. We were told that they wanted to resolve some of the language differences and clarify some unintended results. As a result, we did address those concerns, and after about 45 minutes of discussions, did go through their concerns, and you'll see that I have submitted to you some amendments to the bill intended to address some of those concerns, one of them being perhaps an unintended language presumption that a person was an independent contractor unless they did satisfy the 20-factor test. And so that language has been changed, intended to remove any inference or presumption. There are a couple other small language changes intended to address some of their concerns as well. At the end of the discussion, however, we were informed that they would not support the bill. And one of the reasons given, we understand, is that they did not see that there was anything that was broken. Why do we need to fix it? As a result of that question, we decided that perhaps our Tax Section Executive Committee maybe wasn't broad enough to make a decision on this, so we polled tax section lawyers and business lawyers in the last few days and asked them to give us a response. I've submitted to you responses of over 25 of them and exhibits which commented uniformly from attorney and some CPAs, practitioners, uniformly supporting Senate Bill 40, outlining some of the major problems they see with the fact that there is no conformity between the federal rules and the state rules, and this apparent trap for businesses and advisors alike. I'm going to quote you a couple of these that are interesting from some of the, and by the way, we did receive responses from virtually, I'd say substantially all the major law firms across the state. So some of their tax departments had responded to us. One of them, David Leonard, Churchill Leonard, here in Salem, independent contractor status is a major problem. Anyone who says otherwise is painfully out of touch with the reality of small business in Oregon. I imagine this issue arises 20 times a year in this firm. The chair of the employment group at Ader Wynn says, in my experience, misclassification of employees is one of the most common mistakes made by employers, particularly emerging growth businesses. I guess I'd provide advice on this issue on the average of at least several times a month. Frank Hilton, another attorney, says that, he says, of course, this is not a problem area for the Department of Employment and enables the department to extract from Oregon businesses taxes that shouldn't be paid. And that's his opinion, of course. But that is a point, and that is that maybe we're collecting taxes from those that shouldn't be paying them. There's no expectation of getting any unemployment benefit by the person who is engaged in a true federal rule independent contractor relationship. There are cases and specifics that deal with this issue, and even the auditors from the Department of Employment are aggressive in their stance. I have a personal experience. I represent a number of local theater-exempt organizations. That one of them is involved in children's theater, and using children, training them how to be actors and actresses. As a part of that, they get them to sign a little contract saying we'll pay you $50 or $100 in order to go through rehearsals and be there for the performances. And you don't get paid unless you finish. Well, the auditor was insisting that these people were employees and would call their homes of these primary aged children, asking their parents to speak with them, and for instance, one of the requirements, an absolute mandatory requirement, is that they file a Schedule C. And the auditor would go down the list of the eight factors that are all required and say to the little child, did you file your Schedule C this year? And you know what the response was? What's a Schedule C? So there's an obvious problem with the enforcement as well as the law being different than the federal rules. The dichotomy between having to comply with a set of federal rules and a set of state rules causes a schizophrenic or a split personality worker. And those things, I think, really do need to be addressed.
Just one question, Mr. Chair, before we move on to Mr. Sellers. Mr. Abbott, you said that the department, both the Department of Revenue and the Employment Department, met with you and you made the changes, and then they, being collectively they, said that if it isn't broken, why fix it? Was that collectively they, both of them?
We were on a telephone conference, so we couldn't say who was responsible for that, but we have had other comments since then for which one of the departments did say, well, we don't see a real problem. And so that's what solicited our response to get a poll out.
Senator Walker, if I may, I think on that conference call was primarily employment. And I think it's been primarily the employment that we've tried to work with. To the best of our knowledge, they are the ones that have the most significant issues that we've tried to resolve. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that you've got this great big thick document, because it is a problem. And the system is broken, and I agree with you. It may not be a problem for the employment department, but it is for a lot of people who have problems with them.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Chair Nelson.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my only question for you is, what took you so long to get to the party? I've been working on this issue specifically since 1999. And where were you the last two sessions? That's all I can say now.
Senator Walker was there with me at night.
Where
were you? We were trying to raise fees.
No, I was with him on his bill in 1999. The governor vetoed it.
Before we get to Mark, go ahead. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, members of the committee. Hearing these comments, I kind of wonder if I need to go into the areas that I prepared for. I would like to offer several comments, though. My name is Mark Sellers, and I practice exclusively in the area of tax law as a member of the private bar in Portland, Oregon for nearly 23 years. Of my own personal experience, I can attest to the fact that the distinction between independent contractor and employee under the Oregon statutory criteria is a continuing thorn in the side of tax practitioners and businesses alike. Like the comments that Mr. Abbott put out from other members of the bar and CPAs, I advise clients regarding this issue in probably more than 25 separate instances each year. I also have a minimum of 5 or 6 administrative disputes with the state of Oregon each year on this topic. I can tell you that the time and effort necessary to resolve disputes with the state in this area are substantial, and I can attest to the fact that the Oregon business owners and workers deeply resent the costs of dispute resolution in this area. The federal government adopted the 20 common law factors in 1987 formally. It's my understanding and my experience that they were using substantially similar tests, at least through their collection division, prior to that time. The tests have been criticized as being cumbersome, and they've been criticized as being inconsistent in their application. What they are is they are known. And the reason they're known is because they're based upon the common law. These are common law factors that have simply been listed and described by the Internal Revenue Service in the revenue procedure. Now, although they may be cumbersome in some respects, they're well-reasoned, and they lend themselves to a measured application of those longstanding common law principles. They do lend predictability on a fairly reliable basis, and they classify the relationship between the business and the employee, because after all, in looking at the relationship between an employee and an independent contractor for tax status and every other status, you're looking at the relationship between the parties for purposes of determination of relative rights and liabilities. Oregon's tests don't rely on those attributes. The statutory and regulatory definitions under Oregon laws assess the relationship not based upon clear or relevant or consistent criteria. In fact, in most instances, they don't assess the relationship at all. Instead, Oregon principally relies upon a review of the private conduct of the worker based upon criteria which are neither known by nor subject to the control of the business. Simply applied, the Oregon tests hold that all workers are employees, regardless of the control they have over their own business activities or the economic risks that they bear in conducting those activities.
Moreover, Oregon's approach to the issue often yields patent inconsistencies in the same in the treatment of the same worker under Oregon and federal law. And in addition to being expensive and inconvenient, those inconsistencies also impose certain additional hazards under federal laws governing the treatment of such workers. We believe that in bringing Oregon's laws into conformity with the federal criteria, this will provide a great service to Oregon's business community. Now, we've heard arguments in our conversations with the government that the proposed legislation creates a presumption in favor of independent contractor status. I respectfully submit that the legislation speaks for itself, and if you review it, you will find no such presumption. However, by eliminating the traps that are inherently created by Oregon's criteria, as well as hazards of penalties assessable against people who fall into those traps, Oregon may move toward an improved business environment. Governor Kulongowski aspires to that type of environment when he says that business and government should be partners, not adversaries. And I respectfully submit to you that based upon my experience of some 22 and a half years as a tax practitioner in the state of Oregon, in this area, business and government are often adversaries. We've also heard an argument that by adopting the legislation, the administrative agencies of the state of Oregon would be bound by the federal determination on the same issue. Again, this proposed legislation speaks for itself. No agency is bound by any federal determination. There is no yielding of administrative control over the Oregon concern here. The consistency that is afforded is in the tests that are applicable for purposes of being able to have predictable conduct and predictable treatment between unrelated people, not to yield jurisdiction to the federal government on this issue. Now, it's noteworthy that years of complaints to the Department of Employment and other departments in the state of Oregon have not yielded any action on this at all, other than mere denials that the problems exist. Those denials, based upon my experience and the experience of other tax practitioners in the state of Oregon, are baseless. Those problems do exist. The exodus and failure of many Oregon businesses can be traceable to a regulatory environment which is fraught with these types of problems. This one, Senator Byron, in response to your question, we started now. This is one of the most patent problems, and we regret that we're here in 2003 rather than 1999, but we're trying diligently to make up for lost time. Because of the response of the Department of Employment and the Department of Revenue on this issue, it's apparent that no beneficial change is going to come from within the regulatory process. A beneficial change has to be legislated from without. And for this reason, I strongly support the passage of Senate Bill 40. If the reason for not passing this legislation is an argument that the status quo is good enough for the status quo, then so be it. That's a reason, I guess, for not passing. If the reason is that there's no problem and we don't need to address it, I would respectfully submit that those arguments are a waste of time based upon our experience, and this committee certainly doesn't need to have its time wasted. Thank you very much for hearing my comments.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sellers, if you have a minimum of 6 disputes per year with the Employment Department on issues such as this, I can imagine this is almost a full employment act for your office, since you deal with a lot of these cases.
The point is that they never get very far. Most businesses engage in a cost-benefit analysis at the outset, and when they compare the cost of compliance plus our forecast of what's available administratively before these agencies, they generally wind up throwing in the towel and paying the tax. So when I say there's an administrative dispute, I don't mean a docketed controversy. I mean a conversation with someone at the Employment Department, an informal opinion given, where there is an audit that has arisen. But they don't. The Department of Justice takes the view that there is no problem in this area. The reason that there is no problem from the Department of Justice's point of view, Senator Walker, is because, generally speaking, things don't get to the point where someone's willing to throw enough money at it to get to the Department of Justice level. The problem exists at the ordinary operational business level, in my judgment.
Mm-hmm. And I can respond to that in the fact that I got nailed during Special Session 6 when I hired a subcontractor. and I was prepared to dispute it, and my father-in-law passed away, and it was just got to the point where I decided, you know, I'm not doing this. There are certain things in life you just got to let go. So I paid the tax. The person is now certified as an independent contractor, and we move on. But the paperwork is about like this. It's incredible, just absolutely incredible. And I worked on a case as a court reporter several years ago that you know very well, where the woman is still in litigation. So I'm just stunned and find that the department probably spends a lot of money in these cases. But as you say, people throw in the towel and give up.
Senator Nelson and Senator Walker, members of the committee, we also heard comments regarding the increased expense of administration, which would be visited upon the state by enactment of this legislation. We have never seen any basis for any conclusions that this would be an increased financial burden upon the state in terms of administration. If the total financial burden that is reviewable by this committee includes the financial burden upon the employer and not just upon the state, then we would submit that maybe this is a positive sum game from the standpoint of reducing the overall expense.
We just received this fiscal analysis, and I think there's some decent time to look at this. They've got some comments on it. I'm sure. Do we have some extra copies over there? We can get those. There's some concern about there's some federal issues involved, and so we'll just look at it. Appreciate your testimony. We'll keep.
I might point out this is the third time I've seen this almost identical fiscal.
Chair Nelson and Senator Byard, may I address some fiscal concerns? Since this bill proposes to make Oregon law more consistent with the federal rules, I would suggest that any concern about the fiscal responsibility of Oregon being increased is speculative at best. And the reason is the federal law is already well established. Audits at the federal level can be used by the department to assist them in their determinations before we get very far. Secondly, that the determination made by businesses are much more familiar with the federal 20-factor rules, and they would be able to make a conclusion much quicker. But the reality is the law itself, the determinations under the 20-factor formula are the right analysis as opposed to being something that's not so relevant.
Mark, any response to that?
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, the only other response I would have is we heard, and I did not... we haven't had a chance to respond to arguments that somehow enactment of this legislation might penalize the state in the form of some federal subsidy, and I believe Senator Nelson made reference to that in whatever's before you. In reviewing this, please keep in mind that what we're trying to effect is conformity with federal law. The issue of a penalty being exacted by the federal government for compliance with federal law is one that should probably be scrutinized by this committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keep this issue. It's interesting. We have about the equal number for and equal number against, and what I'll do is call up a couple of folks that are one for and one against. Bob Shiprack and Roger Martin. You want to? You did like this. Didn't you? This is not for four. Did you say four down here?
Yes.
Four. Okay. Mr. Shepard, should not have against. Check your.
Yes. I was going to come up with this plus, but.
Okay. Well
she can come too.
We're all friends here.
Well, I should call
for the pro.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm a lobbyist, but I'm here testifying on my own personal experience of how, in my opinion, onerous this law is. And I would ask you, in a time when our economy is as bad as it's been in my lifetime in the state of Oregon, I think we ought to be looking at all the opportunities to encourage more business in Oregon. And one of the best possible ways to encourage is to encourage people who are my age. I have a birthday today. Who might ordinarily be retired, but who have the same desire to work that I do, who could work as independent contractors. contractors. And I want to illustrate my own personal experience how damn tough the state of Oregon has made that to be. 3 years ago, we hired the Oregon Transit Association, that I'm the executive director of, had the need to prove to you folks in the legislature that there was a need for more help for senior and disabled transportation. We needed a grassroots person who could get together information from all over the state. We looked around through the various people that belonged to our organization. I found a woman who used to be with the Lincoln County Transportation District who had served for years in these capacities, knew all of the senior and disabled folks all over the state, and I hired her as a subcontractor. She lives in Siletz, Oregon. She never came to my office. We made a contract with her to pay her $1,500 a month for 5 months during the 1999 legislative session. We did that, and afterwards, because I'd have to say, besides being well grounded in this, she was not very sophisticated, or maybe she was more sophisticated than I thought, she applied for unemployment. And the claim came to me from the employment division. I said, baloney. Independent contractors can't claim it. Whoa, did I find out wrong. You ought to go find the 8 points, and you probably know them. There's no way you can hire an independent. If these are strictly applied, there's no such thing as an independent contractor of the state, because I should have known that, A, she advertised with other people for this service, that she had most of her business in her home devoted to business, all the things that there's no way, unless I took the time off to go to a private investigation, I could have found out. I got nailed. We had to pay the unemployment. I was fined several hundred dollars. Now, in my mind, the state is pursuing these things for the benefit of state tax collections and unemployment tax collections. And I'm sure you're going to hear from a whole bunch of people, and I want every argument you listen to, including the one my friend Bob Shipwright is going to make, you will find that some businesses profit by this being in existence because it prevents competition. And if this legislature is about refereeing competition within businesses, I'll throw in with you. I think you ought to pass this. You ought to also consider the piece of legislation that the representative from Ontario has in the House of Representatives. I think this is a badly needed law, and I'm sorry I'm two sessions late in supporting it, Senator Beyer.
Counterpoint.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shipwreck, Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council, but I was asked to speak today representing the Employment Advisory Council. It's a group of labor and management folks that advise the Employment Department on policies, rules, and laws, and we unanimously opposed this, both labor and management. One of the things, I guess I've been around the building too long, is that this is not a new idea. This was what Oregon went with until about the 87 legislature changed and created what we call the eight-point test. So we had this rule. Let me tell you what it was like in the good old days. In the House Labor Committee, where I served at the time, we had bills that were dominating in this area. People were gaming the system because, unfortunately, the federal test is so subjective. You could take an example, and all four of you may come up with a different idea of who's an employee and who's an employer. These common law rules, and we went all through this, go back way to master-servant relationships is what they're called, way back in England. So we went all through this. Let me talk about what did you see back in these days under that subjective test that you're being asked to reinstall? People would game the system. They would be employers if it suited them at the time, or employees if it suited them at the time, for purposes of unemployment or workers' compensation, withholding taxes, things like that. I remember having a conversation with a constituent of mine in Estacada. He's a logger, and he used to talk to me. One time I'd see him, he said, well, we got to have that law where, because I'm going to be contracting a job, and I want to be bid fairly. The next time he might be an employee, working for one of these guys, and He wanted the cash, didn't want to have... It went back and forth, depending on your circumstances. We had testimony. This was another funny one from a businessman in Portland who ran a messenger service, you know, the guys that run bikes down the streets and stuff. And he says, you know, I really dislike the federal rule because clearly I believe my messenger people are my employees. I tell them where to go. I pay them all that stuff. And he says, but my competition doesn't. And it's created a financial difference between two identical businesses in the same town. And we had another example, the best ones. We used to talk about this all the time. You're an independent contractor when you're on the roof, roofing, but on the way down, if you fell, when you hit the ground, you're an employee. You then apply for workers' compensation benefits. You weren't a contractor, but under this test, you could say you were. And so then some innocent business person got hit with a workers' comp claim. Sometimes they weren't so innocent because the games that were getting played around this area, there was a lot on both sides. People that wanted to get cash, people that didn't want to pay employer taxes. So there were no rules. There just weren't any rules. So we spent an interim working with industry to come up with the Oregon test. And I must tell you, when we were done, we worked with the Internal Revenue Service, and the representatives from Portland who worked with us on the bill said, we only wish we had your law. Just to point in, to the, if you look at line on page 1, sub 4, line 17 through 20, just read it says that the factors are a guide in determining the existence of the right to control and direct a worker. The degree of importance of each factor varies depending on the occupation and the factual context in which the labor or services are performed. And then you go from there. So I'll just quit. Just wanted to inform the committee. We used to have this law. It didn't work. It created a lot of confusion. A lot of people, I have to counter the proponent's side on this. There were a lot of innocent people that got hurt under the old common law test because they may have thought they were or were not an independent contractor. But given the fact that this is so subjective, anybody could have a different interpretation. We had examples where one state agency would say you're an independent contractor, and another state agency, given the old test, said, no, you weren't. I'll stop there. I understand there's issues out there. There always will be regarding what is an employee and what's an employer. But frankly, I got to tell you, my experience in watching this over the years, it has worked very well for Oregon to have this test. It is a bright line standard that makes it very clear as to what constitutes an employer and employee relationship, and it's served the state well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would just point out that I could show you a case where under the current law we have two different state agencies have administered the law differently, and one has said that it's an independent contractor and one has said it isn't. So the fact that we have a bright line standard obviously still is working.
That shouldn't have happened.
It did.
That should not happen.
No, I appreciate Mr. Shipwreck's question.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Bob Rayner and Lisa Trussell. Bob, you're marked down here as for this, so please.
Yes, I'm definitely for it. Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
Mr. Dodson. I don't think I can do better than the point paper that our attorney wrote for the support.
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Bob Rayner, Western Specialty Products. I don't think I can do better than the point paper our attorney drafted for us in the letter of support from the Portland Business Alliance, except to say that what this does under its current form is it forces my company to look at hiring people from outside the state to come in and do work for us because it's more efficient for us to do that than it is to hire local independent contractors to do that same job. This is not the way you're supposed to operate business. We would appreciate your support so that it's standardized. We do business in the 25 western states. It would sure be nice to have every state conform to the federal government, because those that do make my life a lot simpler. Allows us to do more hiring. We are actually growing, which is kind of rare, but we're doing so, and we'd like to hire more people in the state. Thank you.
Questions for all?
Just one, Mr. Chair, a couple actually. What was your business, sir?
Advertising.
Okay. And you hire people from outside the state to do the work inside the state because they're independent contractors elsewhere but not here?
Correct. We've had them from Colorado, Idaho, Nevada. It's just, it's more efficient to do that because, as I forget who it was, and I apologize for not paying attention to the names, but somebody was talking about writing a check. Well, we just wrote that check because we lost in combat with the person at the state. That was, there was no way for us to win this battle. We went in with our hands tied behind our back. They're talking about this blue standard or fairness. What he's really saying is that it's impossible to be an independent contractor under that formula, because in order to do that, what you're asking me to do is to find out, do they have a separate phone line? Do they have a separate business card? You're asking me to check up on them, and then you're telling me if I check up on them, they're employees. So I can't win that battle, because if I totally ignore what they're doing, which is what you're supposed to do for an independent contractor, then I don't know that they don't qualify. So if that's a fair standard, then please, somebody needs to share it with me, because it doesn't appear that way to me.
And one final question, Mr. Chair. Sir, what kind of things do your independent contractors do for you that makes you want to use independent contractors instead of employees?
It's just the entire process for a small company like mine hiring independent contractors throughout the western United States is cost practical. We can do what we do at our pricing structure. If we were to change everybody over to employee status in the western United States, we couldn't afford to offer what we offer at the prices we offer it. We couldn't do it. It'd be cost prohibitive.
And how many independent contractors do you use?
Range anywhere from a low of 35 to a high of 100.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here today in opposition to Senate Bill 40, in part because of, as you heard a little history from Mr. Shiprack, and I think that you'll perhaps hear some more from Mr. Van Etta. This was a major concern in the late 80s, and AOI was participant and supported the changes that are in the current statute. And you've heard that with anything, whichever way you go, there's going to be questions or concerns, regardless of whether you use the federal standard or you stay with the Oregon one. But one of the intentions with the Oregon one was to make it more defined so it would become less subjective. And as you pointed out, Senator, there's still problems with the apparently with the Oregon law. But trading it and going with where we were before 1989 just may create a new set of problems. So for those reasons, we're also on the Employment Advisory Council that took a position on this.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa, the attempt or the direction I've taken the last two sessions has been to modify the Oregon standards, which obviously have been unsuccessful. That's why we still have them intact. This is a totally new approach to me to look back to going conforming to federal. I thought it was probably pretty ingenious because, you know, it seems like we want uniformly across the United States. But if you're going to oppose this method, would you support, and you probably may not be able to answer that without going back and talking to your people, but modifying, specifically last session, you had to meet six of the eight things, but you had to meet one of the first two, which are the two that, those are the two that always knock someone out. It's those two. So you would have to meet one of those two standards, and then five of the other six.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think that we'd be willing to look at ways to improve it. One of the concerns we have with just completely changing what is in basically on page 3 of Senate Bill 40, which is the old language, some of those things were put in there for specific industries. And Of course, I was not involved in this in 1989, so perhaps Mr. Shiprack and Mr. Vanetta would know better. But the concern is that if you take out the Oregon language, some of that was put in there to protect, for example, I understand agriculture was taken into consideration when they passed the law that's in here. We'd be willing to take a look at changes to the independent contractor language, but we're concerned that the changes we've seen so far are broader than we might anticipate. So in answer to your question, we'd be happy to look at other changes.
Any questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming out. Jonathan Howell and Patrick Graham. Ms. Green, Patrick Green.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Howell. I'm a certified public accountant in Beaverton. My practice is focused on tax and accounting services for small businesses. I think that Senate Bill 40 addresses a long-standing variance between federal and Oregon employment tax law. One of the things I think that Mr. Shiprack mentioned is that there, you know, formerly was conformity between the federal law and the Oregon law. Well, the federal law regulation actually is Revenue Ruling 8741. Which came into existence in 1987. The 20 common law factors existed before that time, but I think that the change in Oregon law previously is in about the same time frame as the federal codification. So I don't know that Oregon was necessarily following federal law as it now stands at that time. I think many small business owners struggle with complexity of the federal definition alone, and we strongly advise clients to establish their own bright line policy for classifying workers that complies with federal law but somewhat simplified. It's simply not practical to, you know, try and do a facts and circumstances test on every worker. Better for a company to have its own policy. It's, however, very difficult for most businesses to document several of the 8 tests set forth in ORS 670-600 and thereby prove that the worker is an independent contractor for Oregon employment taxes and workers' compensation insurance. Workers' compensation insurance is the area that we deal with the most in practice because the workers' compensation insurance has a regular audit cycle that's undergone with most small businesses, and that's where I most frequently deal with it with my client base. I think in industries where utilization of independent contractors is a regular recurring activity, most businesses devote significant efforts and resources towards properly classifying workers and documenting such classifications. Well, that takes time and it takes money. You need to be a certain size to make that work well for you. In the construction industry, the usual documentation for an independent contractor consists of getting their tax ID number with a Form W-9 completed by the worker, as well as the verification of the worker's builder's board registration, contractor's license, and insurance bonding. And then each year, Form 1099 is issued to the worker. These basic documents are normally sufficient for the business to substantiate the worker's status in the event of a federal employment tax audit. However, they may not be sufficient to do the same in the event of an Oregon employment tax or workers' compensation audit because the business normally cannot verify that the worker properly filed their own tax returns and may not be able to verify whether the worker worked for other companies during the year or whether the worker maintains a specific workplace at home as provided in the Oregon statute. Workers' compensation insurance premiums for building trades workers represent a substantial financial cost for the construction industry, and proper classification of such workers is essential to the accurate bidding and costing of contracts. For industries where hiring of independent contractors is a recurring but insignificant activity, verification and documentation is especially onerous. I serve as the treasurer of a small church. When our pastor takes a vacation, our services are conducted by visiting clergy who are usually retired ordained ministers or teachers from a local seminary or college. While an honorarium is paid, the church may not file a Form 1099 since the honorariums paid to a specific minister will usually not exceed $600 in a calendar year. The same is true for substitute organists or pianists. Nevertheless, these workers are properly classified as independent contractors under federal laws. Invariably, when our periodic workers' compensation audit is performed, the sole matter of contention is the amounts paid to these workers, which is usually less than $1,500 a year in the aggregate. Again, the church is normally unable to verify whether the visiting
clergy or musicians have filed tax returns for prior years, nor can they determine whether these persons represent to the public that they are independently established businesses, including four of eight factor tests provided under the Oregon statute. Inevitably, the matter becomes one of auditor judgment, which can create exactly opposite results for two businesses that have identical situations or for the same business in different audit periods. From the standpoint of the worker, classification is very important, especially in the area of employment taxes and retirement plans for the self-employed. A self-employed individual may be funding their own retirement program under the understanding that they are an independent contractor with respect to the businesses for whom they provide services. In the event they are reclassified as an employee with respect to a particular business, such earnings may not be used to compute contributions to their self-employed retirement plan. Additionally, self-employed persons pay certain employment taxes like transit taxes. Reclassifications as employees instead of independent contractors will not only require them to file amended returns to obtain refunds of these employment taxes, but they may be subject to additional income taxes, interest, and penalties in the event retirement plan deductions are disallowed. This uncertainty may pose a significant disincentive for a self-employed individual to fund retirement savings. Reclassification under audit will pose a significant financial hardship for any worker so affected. I urge this committee to support Senate Bill 40 and provide certainty and security for independent contractors and the businesses that utilize their services.
Question?
Mr. Walker? I'm fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Green. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 180,000 union members and their families, including 100,000 workers in the private sector. We're here in opposition of Senate Bill 40 because we feel like that it does change the standard. It turns on its head the current standard, which has a presumption that a worker is a worker unless proven otherwise. If you look at the language on in Section 1, Sub 2, that a worker who performs labor services for remuneration shall be considered to perform the services as an independent contractor if the standards of this section are met, and then goes through. And then it's changed to as an independent contractor unless a relationship of an employer and employee exists. So it changes that. I'd echo what Bob Shiprack said about the factors being listed as a guide, and that seems it seems vague. I don't know why, if people are having trouble complying with the law now, why they would want a standard that seems even more vague by saying the factors listed are a guide. Which continues on into on page 2 and sub 6, the factors listed in subsection 5 of this section shall be applied to the extent possible in a manner that is consistent, which seems also vague. And I think that in terms of the in terms of saying that, you know, in by using the economy and saying that times are bad, therefore we need to change this is really a straw man to kick around. In fact, the reason why we have problems in the wood products industry isn't because of who is or who is not an independent contractor. It's because of high energy costs and maybe unfair trade practices by Canada. You know, the high-tech industry is suffering because of
environmental laws.
Okay. Spotted out. But also, you know, international trade is an issue in the high-tech industry. I mean, Oregon is an export-dependent economy, and so the big problems that we're having in our economy, I would say, aren't due to this law. I would say that in the example of the secretary reading the tests here, I would think, you know, in terms of hiring a secretary, if you look at the standards that we're looking to get rid of about a business card and a separate phone line and that sort of thing, I think that having a secretary come in to do some work, if she's good with the computer, could print out a business card and have one, So I think that, and then the other thing I'll just add, because I don't want to repeat what other people said, is that when I was about 16 years old, I was hired on to do janitorial work at a private school, at a college prep school, and they had me and four of my friends. We got together and we cleaned the school after classes, and then on Saturdays we came in and cleaned the toilets and mopped the floors and cleaned the blackboards and that sort of thing. And the head of the school would give us some cash, and I'd give it out to my friends based on the amount of work that they put in and that sort of thing. And then we did that for about 3 years, and then down the line, I'm 22 years old, get a letter from the IRS saying that, you know, by the way, your boss said that you're an independent business, you're an independent contractor, independent business, therefore you owe employment taxes, FICA, the whole nine yards on my supposed employees. And I think that you have heard how the regulations can be onerous for some businesses and folks trying to meet them, and that's not a good thing. I think that one of the things that we could do is help businesses comply with the law. But I think on the reverse end, workers can get hurt. They go to file for unemployment. It's not there. That sort of thing. So we need to have a bright line standard. And the current standard, I think, holds up. Thanks.
Just one on that last point. Workers get hurt because they go to file for unemployment and it's not there. Not if they know that they have a job as an independent contractor, not as an employee. Wouldn't you agree?
I think the question about whether or not someone is or is not an independent contractor, if the employee doesn't know, in my case, I didn't know what I was. I just knew I was a kid and went to get a job and got paid, and then, you know, you don't know, you know, those sorts of things. I mean, I think that people, you know, who aren't familiar with, you know, the employment system can, you suffer as a result of not knowing. If you're an independent contractor, you have certain rights. If you're an employee, you have certain rights. And I mean, I think that that's where the discrepancy comes in, or the danger comes in.
Well, I don't know. I just have a problem with that analogy, because I see my responsibility as someone who gets a subcontractor. It's my responsibility to tell them that you're not my employee.
Mm-hmm.
You're my independent subcontractor. So you take care of your own taxes and your own stuff. And I think anyone who has a setup like that is very clear with the people who do work for them in that instance. I just don't think there's any gray area. Maybe for you, you were 16, you were just lucky to have a job, even though it was cleaning toilets. You know, it was money in your pocket. I see your point on that level.
Further questions?
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Holt and Fred Bonetta. Did you mark down as four? Please proceed and introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our members practice in retail, hospital, senior care, and mail order and other settings around the state, but pertinent to our discussion today, we have a number of people who work in relief pharmacy, where they go to fill in for pharmacists at a site where, pertinent to the current test, equipment exists. What they bring to the job is their knowledge. The current test, as it stands, continues to threaten the ability of pharmacists to practice their profession independently. That is, outside of a building per se, but to be able to go and work as a consultant or to work as a reliever. And in recent years, it has come to threaten the viability of pharmacies in rural areas, where because of the shadow of the current law, relief agencies are reluctant to operate in the state of Oregon, and it is extremely difficult in rural areas for people to get relief. I spoke to a member not long ago who has been 4 years without a vacation, and it's because relief is simply not available in his part of the state. I'd like to address a couple of points that have been made in earlier testimony. You know, it was noted by the learned panel from the Bar Association that the federal test has been in existence since 1987. Some of our members have been in conflict with the Employment Department roughly half that period, at least. They have prevailed with the Internal Revenue Service. They have prevailed with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and they have prevailed in the courts. And yet the Employment Department persists, and some of that conflict continues, and some of it I think, Senator Beyer, you're familiar with from previous sessions. But to refresh your memory and give you some idea of the tenacity of the department, and I think the dim prospects of actually modifying the existing statute rather than taking the approach suggested by the bar. Back in 1999, when this issue came up, there was a bill that was eventually, over several iterations, narrowed to a point where the only people it affected were relief pharmacists. And the idea was to bring some relief under the law to that very small group of people at that time, then by our best count, less than 100 people in this state. And yet the Employment Department continued to fight the bill and recommended a veto, which ultimately came from then-Governor Kitzhaber. So we don't see any real prospect of regulatory relief, even when the courts side with those who are, in fact, independent contractors by any common sense test. The fact of the matter is that I think Patrick Glenn Green put it rather well. The current law says that you're a worker until proven otherwise. Those were his words. And when you get into conflict with the Employment Department in this state, you are guilty until proven otherwise under the current law. And so we would strongly suggest that we move ahead with the solution brought by the Bar Association, which is to simply follow the federal test. A number of other states follow this or a very similar kind of test, rather than Oregon's unique test, which requires one to meet not one or two or a preponderance of the evidence, but to meet all of the tests in the law, including having business cards and all that stuff that's listed, because there is an and in that list. So if you fail any one of those things, you're guilty of being an employee in the employment department's eyes, and you really, as others noted, cannot realistically, if that test is applied strictly under the current law, be classified as an independent contractor under audit. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Vanatta, sir.
I am Fred Vanatta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association, and I feel a little bit like Mr. Shipwreck. If you live long enough, everything comes around. There is not a person in this room that has spent more time fighting with the Department of Employment than I have. And I also probably should say over this issue, there's nobody that spent more time fighting with the unions than I have. And I come before you today more or less on their side. And I am puzzled about that a little bit.
We all are.
Let me give you some history, and I'll try to be brief about it. But when I was retained by the Oregon State Home Builders Association in 1969, there were no individual independent contractors in the construction business in Oregon. You could not be an individual, a sole proprietor, and be treated as an independent contractor in the state of Oregon. And the residential construction industry was very distraught about that. And I tackled some version of that every session until 1987, until Mr. Shipwreck, who was from the construction industry but the chairman of the House Labor Committee, got tired of seeing me and said, let's fix it. And I'm now hearing, Bob and I are now hearing our fix criticized, and the credit of the young folks around here who were complaining about that, they don't know all the grief that the old law created. I don't question for a minute but what their assessment of the shortcomings, although it is fair to say that I've heard business cards criticized a couple of times, and if people read the existing law correctly and carefully, they would know that business cards are not required. They are just one of six factors where you only need four. But that it's not saying that, I'm not arguing that this current law fashioned is bulletproof. It is so much better than the law before that some of us who have seen very little litigation on it, frankly, over the years since it was adopted, and recognizing it, that I view it more from the construction industry perspective because I hear more about those cases. I am aware of the problem the travel industry has had recently, and I think that was a misfire by the Court of Appeals. There is also a very bad case in the trucker in the agricultural industry where an independent contract truck owner went out to a farm and his truck collapsed on the farm and he crawled under it and fixed it and hurt himself while he was fixing his own truck on the farm. And our friendly court held that he was eligible for workers' compensation from the farmer. Now, the real pain in this issue is not the Department of Employment. They have always been stricter on this issue than the workers' comp auditors, but the real pain comes from workers' comp audits, and if those of you want to know a little bit about how it was in the old days, I would suggest that you ask Senator Starr, because I helped unravel him in an earlier life from a workers' comp audit that was in the five digits, and we have seen in the construction industry over $100,000 worth of efforts to collect over $100,000 worth of workers' compensation premiums when they came through an audit and said that one and that one and that one isn't an independent contractor. Now let me quit wandering for a little bit and be a little specific. Mr. Shipwreck read the sentence that I was going to read to you. The degree of importance of each factor varies depending on the occupation and the factual context. That's what the federal standard was and essentially what we followed in Oregon when we tried to codify it here. And in the construction industry, I can assure you it reduced the amount of litigation substantially. I tried to go through and apply a construction industry standard to these 20 questions. And if these are, and I haven't gone and checked them, I'm presuming that the 20 questions they have here are identical to the ones that the IRS now gives you. I haven't gone and checked that, although under the old law, I used to teach classes to prospective contractors, part of the Construction Contractors Board education requirements on what was an independent contractor. And when I can, and we had, then we had 20, either 24 or 26 questions, the pre-87. And here's the questions they're going to ask you. Which questions, some questions are more important than others. Nobody knows which questions are more important except the guy that audits you, and they'll make the decision. That's exactly what we're bringing back here, is a question that the importance of which will depend on the eyes of the auditor. Can a excavating contractor or a framing contractor, you look at A, where, when, and how. Where and when, the general contractor clearly tells you. So you may well be classified as a worker under that question. You turn to the next question, requiring an experienced worker to work with the worker. Well, in most construction jobs, have a supervisor, an experienced worker, on the scene or at least available to work with the subcontractor, or in this case it would be a worker. Is a laborer services performed by the worker integrated into the business operations? Is excavating integrated into the construction of a house? If you're a framing contractor, are you integrated into the rest of the business? Wouldn't be hard to argue that you are. And you go on to the next one. The person for whom the labor or services are performed hires, supervises, pays assistance, as opposed to the worker. That's very much like the supervisor. But if you're an excavating contractor and the general contractor brings the surveyor on the job to tell you where to dig, is that the assistant? And do you fail the test based on that? They talk about it, then they got two of them. F and Q are very similar. F talks about work is performed, you have a continuing relationship. And the worker does not perform more than de minimis labor or services for multiple unrelated persons. And one of the cases that we took to the state Supreme Court was an excavating contractor in Albany, hired by, and he was, the excavating contractor owned his own backhoe, and one of the larger home builders in the state was the general contractor, and he operated the, it was a little bit heavy-handed. He said, this is what I will pay for excavation per hour, and he circulated that among the industry, among the excavating contractors in Albany. The people that had worked for that came and signed the contract. And one of the people that had signed that contract, he had a lot of work. He worked continuously for almost the entire year for the same general contractor. He had his own backhoe. The subcontractor had his own backhoe, which he brought to the job site. And when he wasn't digging for him, he was building houses on the side, and he was registered with the contractor's board. They knocked him over and declared he was an employee.
Fred, do you think that same person could meet the test in today's law?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Under the criteria that we have written here, I don't believe there'd be any question about that.
Mr. Chair, how would he qualify for the first one, which is the issue on scope and control? If he's being told by the general contractor where he can dig, when he can dig, and how he has to dig it, he cannot meet that test. Because I can, and that's why people were here today. You cannot meet that test.
Well, you go on down the list and look at the ones where they were being registered with the Construction Contractors Board.
But Mr. Venata, you have to meet all eight, not just.
Well,
and that's. But I guess my question would be, Fred, would you be interested in working this so that you could modify the fact you have to meet all eight of these?
I won't continue to go through that list. I have a thought that occurred to me, and I've checked this with absolutely nobody, including my client. But I'm going to lay it on the table anyway, and that is, look at the possibility of using both of these, either or. And I don't know what the lawyers would tell you about it. But if you couldn't skin through one, maybe you could skin through the other. And I'm very sympathetic to the folks that get caught with a federal standard and a state standard that are different. The problem that we dealt with here under this Oregon system was that the Department of Revenue generally let you through. The Department of Employment was the strictest enforcer. Sometimes workers' comp followed the Department of Employment, and sometimes they didn't. And we had three agencies in Oregon where you frequently got two opinions, and sometimes you got three opinions. And this statute helped eliminate some of that. Now, the difference between the federal and the state, I think, is a serious problem, and I'm not sure how we get to deal with the federal and state problem and not allow the state agencies to come to a bunch of different conclusions, as well as have years of litigation while we figure out what the 20 questions mean. Those are the concerns that I have, is how do we avoid the years of litigation with the 20 questions, keep the three state agencies in Oregon from coming to different conclusions.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, Fred, you're not opposed to working on clarifications or modifications of the statute. You just don't believe that going back to the federal standards is the proper way to do it.
That is exactly correct. I'm not claiming, and I think we've heard ample testimony and seen some cases that suggest the existing statute is not working as well as it did in the early 90s. So we ought to try to fix it, and I don't question that at all.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Jessica Harris and John Schellenberg. 3 o'clock. Yeah, we have some of our committee members have other committees, so they have to leave. Okay, well, we're not going to move this thing in any work session. We're going to keep moving. So, testimony from the heart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. I'll be very brief, as you've already heard a lot of testimony, and since the bill isn't going to move today anyway, which is exactly what we were going to recommend, the agency's concern is that we have significant concerns that changing the law to just take it back to the federal would potentially create some unintended consequences, especially for the industry, that we need some more time to take a look at potentially some reforms to meet some of the other concerns that were raised today, but that we aren't involved about just erasing what we have right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Mr. Shiprack and Mr. Venata, I guess I'll be showing my age by saying I was there too when we redid this. But could I say that I was also a very young man at that point?
At least much younger.
Mr. Chair, I do need to run too, so I guess I'd just like to ask the same question of these two. So your testimony was not opposed to doing anything, but to doing this specifically, you're not opposed to working on this area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, yes. We think there may be some changes that can be made, maybe some that need to be made based on the testimony I've heard, but much of what is in there because agriculture, and I was a part of that, made sure it was there. In agriculture, we do a lot of custom work, a lot of custom farming, farmer to farmer, fertilizer applicators, hay balers, all of those people, they never qualify as an independent contractor under this law. And it took everything that's in the current law now to make sure that they did qualify. And so I would inform you that there is a House Bill 2649 on the House side. They're working on this very issue. It came up over there because of a company called LRI down at Blatchley, where the people are working for this company as independent contractors. That's the way they want to work, but it isn't working for them either. They were deemed to be not independent contractors. So, yeah, there's some work that needs to be done, and we'd be happy to work on that and would ask you to delay this bill maybe until 2649 comes over here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with so far the people who testified in opposition to the bill. None of them opposed the bill. The bills that worked on the last two sessions when we were trying to modify the Oregon law. So I would support that they are just not interested in going back necessarily to the 2020 question federal. Mm-hmm. But if we look at a modification of the Oregon law, that perhaps we can get into the law. Thank you.
Sounds very good. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Also had James Holman and Ed Glad. James said he was for it, and Ed says he's against it. If you guys want to basically put words, the direction we're going here is that we're going to work this bill, and we've got a House bill going on. I just want to give you an idea, guys, not to use it. Anyway, so we better, since we don't have a forum, we'll close a public hearing and go to a subcommittee hearing.
Go ahead, James.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is James Holman. I am the president of Pacific Courier Services. We are a small business based out of Portland, Oregon. We've been in business just under 2 years, and you've received a lot of great testimony so far as to the issues that this presents, and a lot of it have come from lobbies and special interests, but just from a pure business perspective, it's created many challenges from our perspective growing and starting up our business. In starting our business, a little bit of background. I was a senior executive of a transportation company covering many of the western states. And as a practical matter, in the state of Oregon, it's very difficult to differentiate federally versus the state statutes regarding employees and independent contractors. In other states surrounding us, that didn't exist. So really what that creates here in Oregon is a very unfriendly business climate. It also creates a little bit of a problem for us when we're looking at allocating resources towards growth, because we are a growing company and we're doing okay right now. We are looking at growing outside of Oregon as opposed to inside of Oregon. So, for example, instead of allocating resources and growing, say, down in southern Oregon or down on the coast, we might look at moving over into Idaho or Northern California, simply because our resources would be better spent in a climate that is more conducive to our business model, and it doesn't create this. The word trap is a great word because that's exactly what this is. By not having a consistent model or standard, we're put in a position because we really operate from a very high ethical and moral background. We want to do the right thing and comply with everything. But at the same time, do we W-2 our contractors? Do we 1099? Do we do one thing for our contractors in the state of Oregon versus a federal application is going to be different? You've heard these questions raised repeatedly. Well, those are very real questions facing our business every day. Those are not just hollow arguments. Those are very real questions. So it poses a question to us to really where do we want to allocate our resources. Interestingly enough, you've heard briefly touched upon, who's against it and some of the issues with the employment department. You know, I would argue one reason there has not been a lot of litigation in this area is the cost of dispute resolution is very high. Dispute resolution, although we will continue to dispute claims or unemployment claims as they come along, again, very bad for business because those detract resources from our business and from our people and what we want to do. The last thing I want to do is spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on attorneys fighting the employment department over something that has clearly set us up to fail as a business. It just does not make good business sense. Federal standard. The federal standard is not perfect. I wouldn't argue that it is. I would argue, though, in my previous life before starting my own business, it was much easier to mediate in those states than it is in the state of Oregon because many other states follow that more strictly. Now, some had actually a looser interpretation, and maybe that was wrong to that degree, but Oregon is the most extreme state, probably this side of the Mississippi, in what they're trying to do here. And, again, you know, having dealt with thousands and thousands of drivers in my district, Oregon is a very anti-business state. And I can tell you, as a regional manager at that time, we made a conscious effort not to invest into this state, and we allocated our resources elsewhere, again, because of the labor climate. So just something, again, to consider. You've heard a little bit of testimony I'll just touch on briefly. But I think the one thing with the people, the common theme with the people who oppose it is nobody's disputed there's an issue. And, I mean, clearly there is. You hear quite a bit of testimony about the federal standard is very subjective. Well, really, just about every statute is subjective to a degree. And you've even heard some examples of why it didn't work, or I believe Mr. Shipwreck said, he had a friend who had a messenger service, and he told him where to go, and this, that, and the other. Well, really, that's incorrect. The customers determine where the couriers go. The company has no, we don't pick up or deliver. The customers determine that. So you hear all these ambiguous arguments, but when you really get down to the facts of the matter, and if you properly classify your working individuals, we feel the federal standard is much better than the state, and the consistency will make it much easier for us to make business decisions on how to grow our business. One last thing I'd like to point out, if I may. The language currently says those eight components are guidelines. It has been my experience, and having been through many of these in many different states of these disputes,
the employment department takes those guidelines and moves them into some type of strict standard. And there's really very little recourse unless you have very, very deep resources to fight that. You're really, as a small business or a mid-sized business, you're stuck. And so you're back in this cost-benefit analysis. Do I really want to spend the dollars fighting this over a $100 insurance, you know, a tax claim? And does it really make sense for my business? Most businesses will bow out at that point, but that does not in any way negate the fact the employment department is incorrect. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Ed Glad, and I'm a representative of the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I'm not quite as old as Mr. Vandata or Bob Shiprack. 20 years, though, as a carpenter. A couple of the elements since 1987, when this law was actually drafted and put to use here, is in the construction industry, certainly, there was temporary labor, people who came in as temporary labor, but in the last 7 to 8 years, the flood of folks that have come in working temporary labor on construction sites is phenomenal, the impact that it's had on our industry. The efforts to be able to delineate between a subcontractor, an independent contractor, and a contractor, I think are a very noble cause for the state to actually get into because of the impacts that it has on the workers themselves when they complete the tasks that they have either solicited to do or have been directed to do by the contractor that they're working for. And that's very, very important because there's a lot of people that will take a job just because the job has been offered to them. They believe that they're employees. They don't necessarily see themselves as independent contractors. But when it comes time to take care of the other businesses that independent contractors have to do, filing their taxes, perhaps applying for unemployment, perhaps seeking workers' comp for an injury that was sustained on the job, they find out that they've been classified by someone else, the employer, as an independent contractor. In order for the employer to avoid the liabilities that are inherent in the relationship between the worker, the carpenter who set himself up to build the house, and the employer or the contractor who says, actually, you are in this other classification. We would like to be a part of a task force or working group that would take a look at some of the criteria and perhaps make it more efficient for business to do that. But we certainly would not encourage lightening the standards or blurring the lines between what an employer and employee is. We believe that the federal standards all across the nations are being challenged by the fact that there are a lot of people that are claiming themselves or are being forced to claim themselves as independent contractors in order to avoid not only remuneration in taxes but also in their workers' comp expectations and the requirements that society has that if you're going to work in our industry in a dangerous job, you better make sure that someone, if it's not you, your employer, certainly not the state, is going to take care of your accident or injury when it happens on the job. We don't want to see those costs go up for the state because you go to the hospital with a broken arm, you know, you're not covered by workers' comp. Somebody's going to pay for it, and it ends up in the community. So thank you.
I just have one. I mean, the point you make is very valid, and I don't know where this ties into employer avoidance under the status quo, or if we were to, you know, reconform with the feds, whether, you know, an employer would or would not still try to take advantage of that. But I think your point is very valid about making sure that those costs are borne in terms of injuries for employers. I mean, I just in a personal experience when in our home, you know, we hired a window washer from a window washing company in the Yellow Pages. The guy came out to wash the windows and fell and hurt himself and was in the hospital, I think, you know, $10,000 for one day, just the first day. You know, he was unconscious and all this. But turned out he had no workers' comp because they, quote, classified him as an independent contractor, even though he was directed to, you know, for his assignments and everything else. And so I think that, you know, I think your point is very valid, is that no matter what we do, whether it's, you know, these rules or those rules, they should be certainly for the benefit of making sure that businesses understand the rules and don't have undue burdens, but at the same standpoint, not provide any a special incentive for someone to to not be able to meet their obligations when those workers are injured.
Exactly.
That's one of the issues that we try to deal with.
Right. Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, just as a little illustration here, about 8 years ago, 9 years ago in Hillsborough, we started a project there that is now the prison, which seems to be the central real estate in the city of Hillsborough, you know, the jail there. And the first part of the project, there was a contractor that came in from out of state, bid the job, got the job, and basically was dependent on a patron, a leader of a work crew, to supply the labor on that job. And being a prevailing wage job, the relationships became very complicated when the employees, who were not represented by a union, they were represented by a patron, found that they weren't getting compensated appropriately, that they weren't getting paid, period. Now, you know, wherever you're at with prevailing wage, you know, in terms of your philosophy there, not getting paid at all for the work, you know, these employees were struggling to be able to. We had in that period of time, we had 75 people that came to join our little local in Hillsborough, almost doubled the size of the carpenters local in Hillsborough. Out of those 75, four of the employees' wives were pregnant. And so they were moving on to they were moving into a situation that was forcing the city of Hillsborough, actually the county hospital system, to be able to somehow birth these babies and make sure that the women don't die in the process here. But there was no food that was happening. So you can see that employee relationships, we can delineate anything we want within the law. But in the end, if you don't have those delineations, there are people on both sides, on the labor side and on the employer side, that are going to try and play the system. What the law says here, the strictures of the Oregon standards, if you meet those strictures, you're going to certainly meet the standards of the federal. And so what we just said in Oregon, is, and this was in 1987, as Mr. Shiprock said, or 89, you know, meet these standards and you're fine with the federals. And so if somebody wants to set up business here in Oregon, they should need to look at the law in Oregon and live by the law in Oregon. You know, there's other parts of Oregon standards that we have that the rest of the country doesn't abide by. And we started with, you know, huge ideas here in Oregon that the rest of the country more or less considers. So.
Good. Thank you. Appreciate it. Anything else?
Thank you.
Renee. Thank you for your patience.
Save the sacrificial lamb for that.
Yeah.
Shall I?
Yes. Might turn one of those mics on, I think.
Chairman Nelson, member of the committee. My name is Renee Bryant.
Do that a little bit more there.
Better. My name is Renee Bryant. I'm the tax manager for the unemployment insurance program at the Employment Department. And I've given you some lengthy written testimony. I'll try to make it less lengthy in my oral remarks. But I wanted to go over a couple of points with you. First of all, the U.S. Department of Labor has informed the Employment Department that adoption of Senate Bill 40, as it is currently written, would most likely result in the state of Oregon being found out of conformity with federal requirements for the unemployment insurance program. The Department of Labor is in the process of formalizing a formal written letter for us, but they have not provided that at this time. Federal law mandates that the state must conform with the federal requirements for the unemployment insurance program or face certain losses of federal funding. For the state of Oregon, that would mean about $142 million in federal administrative funds that come from the Department of Labor. And for Oregon employers, that would mean an increase in taxes because without an unemployment insurance program, pardon me, yes, sir.
You say if they are out of conformance with the federal, but if they stay within the federal, they wouldn't be
correct.
Subject to that. So I don't quite get that. I mean, if you say the federal says you have to stay within the federal guidelines, and Oregon's the only state that's doing it differently, how do we risk losing that?
Mr. Chair, if your question is out of conformance with the federal IRS guidelines, then I need to clarify that it's the Federal Department of Labor guidelines and the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, not the tax act that the Internal Revenue Service administers. So the Department of Revenue FUTA Tax Act is different than the IRS standards. Okay. We are currently in conformity with the federal requirements. Okay, under the Department of Labor's estimation. They have reviewed our independent contractor statute, for instance, and said that it sufficiently conforms with the federal standards for us to operate an unemployment insurance program. Okay.
Can I follow up on that? Because I'm a layman, okay? So I just got more confused based after Senator Nelson's question. So in simplistic language for me, perhaps, if you are to conform the IRS determination of independent contractor, okay, the state of Oregon, to the IRS determination of federal contractor, the 20 points,
mm-hmm.
okay, if we conform to the federal definition, why does that then put our unemployment tax rules out of compliance?
Okay.
I'm trying to understand this nexus here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, it's not the 20 questions itself that are the problems that have been noted. It is other language within the bill, and I'll be happy to go through that with you and tell you what that is. I have not had the opportunity to see the amendments that the State Bar Committee has submitted, so I'm assuming, based on our prior conversations, that they have dealt with all of those, but not having seen them, I can go through those particular problems if the committee desires.
Well, those are germane just because it's the fiscal that everybody's
Correct.
Eyes go out, and if the fiscal is dealt with because of the language of the bill, that's one question, versus, well, we can't do anything about the fiscal.
Correct. Mr. Chair, should I go into those now? Is that what you would prefer?
Let's go ahead, yes.
With respect to the conformity issues, then, I believe one of the I believe a couple of the speakers may have already addressed some of these issues. Again, I haven't seen the amendments that the Bar Committee has offered. But there was concern on behalf of our federal partners that a significant conformity issue could arise with the language in the bill that appears to create a presumption in favor of there being an independent contractor status unless or until an employment relationship was established. Federal law, the Department of Labor federal law, requires that there be an employment relationship, that there be a presumption of subjectivity for purposes of unemployment insurance programs. Unless or until an independent contractor status is proven. So it's just a matter of reversing that presumption, and I'm assuming that the language has already been amended that could take care of that. The other concerns that raised by the Department of Labor had to do with the language in the bill that refers to the criteria being applied in a manner consistent with the application of the federal law to the collection of unemployment taxes, so forth and so on. This section of the law would be almost impossible to administer because the exemptions for coverage under IRC do not exist under FUTA. FUTA requires the Oregon Employment Department to make independent determinations about whether or not independent contractor relationships exist. And they're not happy with the language that would seemingly require the state to defer to any language or interpretations by the Internal Revenue Service. I understand that the proponents of the measure don't read it that way. I'm just relaying what the Department of Labor has said they see some potential problems to be. The other potential problem lies in the section of the bill that refers to the safe harbor provisions of the Revenue Act of 1978. Such provisions do not currently apply for payroll taxes, which is what we collect at the Employment Department. FUTA requires payment of taxes for services performed by an employee. The safe harbor provisions do not change the status of an individual from an employee to an independent contractor. What that does is that provides tax relief for an employer. Therefore, under the provisions of the proposed measure as it's written, non-payment of payroll taxes under safe harbor provisions would violate the FUTA requirement for payment of taxes. In other words, there'd still be an employment relationship there. Safe harbor would provide tax relief, but we'd have an inconsistency with a conclusion in under federal law that there is an employment relationship potentially, and the provision for tax relief, so that people wouldn't be able to have their wages count to calculate an unemployment insurance claim and therefore collect unemployment insurance. All of these things could potentially also violate federal law requirements for payment of benefits when due, because despite an actual employment agreement or relationship, there would be no wages attributable to the employment relationship. Those are the things that the federal government, Department of Labor, have outlined to us are potential conformity issues. Again, the conformity issue could result in about $142 million worth of administrative funds being lost to the program. And employers in Oregon would be required to pay about $950 million in additional taxes. That's based upon a calculation of the number of employees, the wages paid, and paying full FUTA, which is 6.2%. So, assuming, though, that conformity issues can be taken care of, and I'm willing to assume that, Employment Department does have concerns about the complexity, if you will, the vagueness or the uncertainty of the IRS guidelines. We believe that it will likely lead to increased cost of administration and additional workload, which could also put us out of conformity with federal requirements for performance. The Employment Department did not take a position in 1989 when the legislation that created ORS 670-600 came to be. We were neutral. We said we could administer the law. Since that time, we've gotten less neutral, I guess, in that we think it's worked very well. We think it's a straightforward recipe, and we have polled the employer community in 2000, 2001, and the resounding and overwhelming response from the participants in that survey was that they believe the law is working well and does not need to be changed. During the late 1990s,
you have a copy of that survey, please.
Senator, I thought we had offered to provide that to you, but I will make sure you get one by the end of the day.
I may have it someplace.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, do you have a copy of that by any chance? Okay. We'll make sure that all the committee members get one.
Please.
During the late 1990s, President Clinton convened an economic summit in the state of Oregon. At that time, the number one concern raised by Oregon employers was the complexity and uncertainty associated with applying the IRS guidelines for determining independent contractor status. There are currently only four other states in the United States, or four states, that actually have adopted and used the IRS guidelines. And those are Rhode Island, Missouri, North Dakota, and Texas. We have talked to representatives from those four, from three of those four states. And I just wanted to pass along some of their comments. In Rhode Island, they said the state adopted the IRS guidelines about 5 years ago. They are required to consider IRS factors, but they are not necessarily bound by them. And they have told us that it's not unusual for them, even under those circumstances, to reach different determinations than the IRS does. In Missouri, they used the language arbitrary and capricious in the application of the language. The state has found a lack of consistency in using the 20 factors because no one factor weighs more heavily than any other. They say there's always room for doubt and disagreement, and they have had cases where they have differed from the determination of the IRS. Some cases have actually had to go to court based on that difference. In Texas, the use of the 20-question guidelines create what they call lots of gray areas. A ruling by the IRS does not necessarily bind Texas to make the same determination on the same set of facts, and in many cases, they have in fact differed. We have not had the opportunity to talk with any officials from the state of North Dakota, so I can't give you any background on what's happening in that state. I did talk with an individual named Jan Alexander, who is the senior program analyst in the Taxpayer Advocates Office in the Portland office of the IRS. And when I asked her what she thought of their independent contractor test, she told me, "It's ugly." She is not aware of any existing problems that the IRS has with the way that the state of Oregon is interpreting and administering the current Chapter 670-600. Give you a little bit of anecdotal stuff that's not here in the written testimony. I started my career with the state of Oregon as an assistant attorney general in 1985. I worked for the Employment Department as one of my primary agencies. And I spent about 80% of my time going to hearings for the Employment Department representing them in independent contractor cases. This was the number one contested case issue that the Employment Department faced at that time relative to tax hearings. Since that time, the state does not typically use, the state of Oregon does not typically use an assistant attorney general in all the tax hearings. We have probably about 20 to 30 a year that are involving this issue. One other thing about the IRS. I found it very interesting to go to their webpage relative to independent contractors. It's the first sentence on their webpage concerning the criteria states, the tax law covering independent contractors is very complicated. All of this is simply to say, Senator, that we don't believe necessarily that moving to the IRS standard is going to result in better customer service. It's going to make it easier and simpler for businesses or even attorneys to agree on and follow the law. The way the law is written now and the way that the law is proposed to be written, there's always going to be room for disagreement. This goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, as Representative Shipwreck said earlier, to master-servant relationships. And as long as there are attorneys in the world, and I'm one of them, we'll disagree. In summary, I'll get over to the other part. We think we have a simple formula in Oregon. Employers are used to it and comfortable with it. We are concerned about the potential administrative costs with the proposed legislation, including more contested cases and more cases that would end up going to the Court of Appeals. There are not that many that go there now. We do consider the IRS criteria to be more vague and less certain. And one other thing, wish I had a better audience, although you're a wonderful audience, Senator Nelson.
Very, very attentive, Barbara.
A larger audience.
Larger.
Governor Kulongoski has called upon the state agencies to examine their laws and rules and find ways to streamline processes and make it easier for businesses to do business in Oregon. We believe that adopting what is essentially a more complex criteria for determining employment relationships used by the IRS is contrary to that goal. The governor has communicated to us that he has some concerns about this bill. I would like to say also that during our prior conversation with the members of the VAR committee, I told them that I thought that they raised many significant and important public policy questions. And as other individuals who've testified today have said, neither of these resolve all of those public policy questions, either the current law or the proposed law. But certainly there is an opportunity here that has presented itself to revisit some of those public policy questions, maybe have a more in-depth discussion about them with more people at the table who can present the differing views, and maybe there are some ways that we can agree to disagree and agree to make some improvements. And I'm happy to answer any additional questions
that
you have.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And I guess my sense of the testimony is that there is some customer dissatisfaction out there, or else we wouldn't be here. And it may be that there's less litigation because, at least from the testimony of a couple folks, is the fact that why bother? You know, why spend the money on attorneys when you know you're going to lose? You just pay it and go forward. And so there's just some issues that were raised, I think, that kind of piqued my curiosity as to can we approve the bill. I think Senator Byer's comments are asking that we try and do something, and if you'd be willing to be a part of a group to try and work this out somewhere or another. We also have a House bill sitting over there, House Bill 2649, and so we'll be working on that. Senator Meskin, you have
anything? You heard all the testimony this afternoon, and it does, I think, just echo what Senator Nelson has said. It seems to be that whether you look at the bill modified from its current drafting stage, or as some other testimony has been that, you know, we don't want to go back to this, but we do have some problems and we can make some minor modifications. It does certainly, I think, beg the question that the status quo itself isn't working correctly. And, and I think to the extent that you could be very, very helpful in really getting to those core issues that, that both proponents and opponents of the bill have still have articulated that the status quo is unacceptable. Maybe we can solve some of those problems for businesses, provide certainty and also protection for those workers without having maybe to make major changes, but certainly making some modifications in those areas in which I think have the testimony has clearly said there's a problem.
Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, yes, I believe that individuals have raised issues relative to some problems they believe they've had with the system. I believe those feelings are heartfelt. For every customer survey saying it's broken, I can hand up another one saying it's wonderful, it's working fine. There are some very significant divisions, and I think one of the issues for the employment department and one of the reasons that some divisions exist has to do with where we come from sort of philosophically and what we're trying to do at the employment department, who we're trying to cover with independent contractor language. And that is that for purposes of unemployment insurance, and the reason the statute was written the way it is that they actually want it to be broader than what has been traditional independent contractor relationship, meaning that there are certain situations where an individual is at risk for unemployment based upon a single relationship generally that they have with one employer. And in those situations, those are the kinds of people that the unemployment system is designed to protect, if you will, and to be there for in times of economic distress, such as we're going through right now. Those are the kinds of folks so that when that one employer disappears for whatever reason, good or bad, that person will have something to fall back on. When that person has something to fall back on, then communities have something to fall back on, too. There's not then secondary unemployment caused by the fact that you can't go to the dry cleaner or the grocery store or the gas station. Communities are, in fact, enriched, if you will, because unemployment insurance provides some temporary partial replacement of wages. And so that's why the statutes have been drafted broadly, and the position that the employment department would take in the future is there needs still to be that consideration, at least for purposes of unemployment insurance, that those kinds of relationships are protected.
I guess the argument on the other side is if you don't have employers, don't like to come to Oregon to do business because it's difficult to do business, then, I mean, which comes first? So I thank you. I really do appreciate your patience. There's a lot of questions here in our mind that I think need to be answered. I'd like to get a group of people together and try and work this out somewhere or another so we can...
Senator, we're happy to come to the table anytime.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you. And I don't think we have any more folks signed up for this. And thank everybody for their patience and you folks for coming down from all places in the state of Oregon. I hope... we can work some of these issues out and make some progress here. Close the subcommittee hearing, and if there's no further business, we'll shut down the and close the public hearing. Thank you. Thank you. We'll just get a group of people together. You guys want to start calling people and kind of coordinate to Dennis? Would that be good? Yeah, he's good to go. I don't think I got it. If it makes sense, I don't know. I added some names. I don't know.